John Packer, thank you for joining RFI.
My pleasure.
You are a professor of law at the University of Ottawa in Canada. You were in Paris at the National Assembly to attend a conference on the situation of Rohingya in Myanmar and Bangladesh. You're very familiar with Burma, and that since 1992, where you were the assistant to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Burma. Now, following a request submitted by lawyers to the ICC to open an investigation into ongoing atrocities against the Rohingya people by Myanmar, atrocities tantamount to genocide, they say, the ICC prosecutor asked the court to rule on whether it has jurisdiction over alleged deportation of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar to Bangladesh. The ICC has asked Bangladesh for written observations around the circumstances surrounding the presence of Rohingya in the country. Now, you seem to think that having recourse to the ICC might not be the best action.
Yes, thank you. First of all, let me just say that I am all in favor of holding persons individually responsible for commissions of international crimes. It has important effects, particularly those persons who may hold power in various governments. But we need to understand how this works or does not work. And in the case of the International Criminal Court, first of all, it has limited jurisdiction. And that jurisdiction is limited territorially. It requires states, for example, to accept the jurisdiction. And in this regard, Myanmar has not accepted the jurisdiction of the court. So there are only two other ways, potentially, for any of this matter to come before the International Criminal Court. The first is through a referral from the Security Council of the United Nations, and that requires an agreement of the Security Council without a veto. So you can imagine immediately that's problematical, perhaps near to impossible to occur if one of the permanent members of the Security Council would veto. But let's just assume it does come. That's one possibility. The other possibility right now being pursued by the prosecutor of the ICC is to seek jurisdiction with regard to a specific crime called deportation, which implicates the state that causes a deportation into the effects territorially on the country that receives the persons deported.
And this is why the ICC is waiting for Bangladesh to submit its written observations on the circumstances surrounding the alleged forced deportation of Rohingya people from Myanmar into Bangladesh.
So that's correct. So now, assuming the International Criminal Court gets jurisdiction, now the next question would be the possibility to actually identify persons who would be alleged to be responsible, and third of all, to actually capture and bring any of those persons before the court. Both of those are not so easy. We already have the example of a person with an indictment, Bashir of Sudan, flouting the court's authority in that regard. Now let's assume all of that goes well, and then we have a prosecution that will take years. And we assume that the persons being prosecuted survive. Remember, Mr. Milosevic did not. He died during the prosecution. And let's assume we get a guilty verdict. And then those persons might be subject to what? They would be subjected to terms of imprisonment, a personal individual sanction. None of that will address any of the causes nor reparations needed with regard to the Rohingya. There will be no order of return. There will be no order of return of property, no return of nationality. So it's simply not an institution that will address the underlying causes or the nature of the problem. It cannot, because that's not the character of the court. From my perspective, therefore, as important as it is to pursue it, nonetheless, we have to think about what are the alternative possibilities to address the real problem, and that's why I would rather focus on the Genocide Convention as a treaty between states and holding states responsible.
We're talking about the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, adopted by the United Nations in 1948.
That's correct. So that convention, which was elaborated when Burma was a member state of the United Nations, Burma voted in favor of the adoption of that treaty, and Burma subsequently signed and ratified it in 1956. So Myanmar, as the current government, is obligated under that treaty both to prevent, and if it fails to prevent, then to punish persons responsible within its jurisdiction. It is manifestly, in my view, clearly failed to do either. But in any event, to the extent that there appear to be breaches of that convention, it is then incumbent on the 148 other states parties to that treaty to respond. So those same countries might want to ask themselves, what are they doing themselves as states vis-a-vis Myanmar? They don't need to go to any court, by the way. But if states wanted to bring this matter to an international judicial institution, they have one available, which is the International Court of Justice, the ICJ in The Hague. Not the International Criminal Court, but the International Court of Justice. Unfortunately, as far as I know, Myanmar has not accepted the contentious jurisdiction of the court. In other words, won't accept to be accused by other states directly. But states could mobilize to request an advisory opinion of the court, which would be a very powerful review of the situation, during which every state with a concern has a right to express itself before the court on what it considers breaches, what it considers implications, and what it would ask for in terms of reparations.
So it is the responsibility of a state to invoke the convention.
Absolutely. This is a matter of what's called inter pares, between different states, between parties. Their obligations are to each other and amongst each other. The object and purpose of the treaty is to stop genocides from occurring, to stop another Holocaust. That was the origin of the idea. Not to wait. It would obviate the purpose of that treaty to say that all of this depends on finding a few individuals you can try at the ICC at some point in the future.
What evidence does the country who would invoke the Genocide Convention have to submit?
The only evidence needed is that the state itself believes there is a basis of a dispute. The standard for a breach of international law is balance of probability. So it's a much lower standard than international criminal law, first of all. But second of all, the International Court of Justice has said in a previous case, the Bosnia case on genocide, that in respect of the Genocide Convention specifically, the standard may be a standard of reasonable certainty, but that's still far below a reasonable doubt, which is the individual criminal's standard. So states basically just need to say, look, do we have sufficient evidence in our observation, do we have sufficient testimonial, physical, documentary evidence that there seems to be a prima facie breach of the Genocide Convention? If they feel that, then they should act under the Genocide Convention to do something about it. And one obvious way, if they wanted a judicial recourse, would be to seek the International Court of Justice to share its views.
So they don't have to submit a wealth of evidence then?
Not to initiate the action.
If having recourse to the UN Convention appears to be such an easier process, why hasn't it been done?
Well, the obvious response to that is that states are extremely hesitant to effectively accuse one another of breaches of such a fundamental instrument. This is a problem of international law and relations.
Well, we can understand that Bangladesh might feel pressured. We can understand that China, absolutely not interested. It has heavily invested in Myanmar. India wouldn't want to put itself in a delicate position there. But there are so many other countries which might not feel the leverage of those Asian countries. Why aren't they doing anything?
So that's an excellent question. Not only is it a question of certain ASEAN member states are heavily invested in Myanmar, some other states have prospective interests and wish to keep a finger in the pie, let me put it that way, with regard to economic interests. But you are quite correct that there are many, many other states that don't have such interests and are not so implicated and therefore should not be so constrained. Nonetheless, there is this kind of hesitancy of states to take this forward. But as a matter of international law, they are actually obliged to act, because this is a breach of the Genocide Convention would be considered a breach of what's called erga omnes obligations, an obligation against everyone. This is a public order and an international relations and law question. Therefore, certainly those states which are not directly implicated really have no excuse to explain why they would sit passively in the face of such a breach of such a fundamental instrument. To sit passively in the face of known breaches raises a question of that state's own good faith undertakings, and that would be a breach of what's called pacta sunt servanda, which is a legal phrase to say that a promise must be respected. But on the moral level, for example, the United Nations in 2005 also adopted the responsibility to protect as a political statement, clearly saying that in such cases, and it talked about crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing, by the way, which is not technically a legal matter, it specifically says that states hold this fundamental responsibility to protect the population within that state. And if they fail, if they are unwilling or unable, there is a residual obligation on the community of states to act.
We're talking about alleged genocide against the Rohingya people. Do we have enough evidence to indicate that indeed the Myanmar state committed genocide?
Yes, so genocide is defined, I'm not speaking about it in moral or vernacular terms. I mean under the Genocide Convention, it is explicitly defined, comprising distinct acts of genocide in addition to acts that would be related to genocide and therefore still covered by the treaty, such as complicity in genocide, conspiracy for genocide, planning of genocide, even if it's never carried out. All of those are still breaches of the treaty. Nobody needs to die for genocide to occur. For example, the forced displacement of children from one group to another for purposes of destroying that group in whole or in part is itself a breach of the treaty.
And that applies to Rohingya people?
That would apply in different ways. But for example, they were subject for many years to a two-child policy, which was below their own replacement level, and tailored on specifically Rohingya, specifically in two regions of northern Rakhine. So it was exactly targeted and specifically upheld and endorsed by the government of Myanmar, the responsible authorities. You know, compiling that evidence is not difficult. The government has adopted laws such as the stripping of nationality. There's not much evidence you need to accumulate for that.
So what you're saying, in effect, is that there is a wealth of evidence showing that, indeed, genocide is being committed?
Absolutely. So the acts of law, public policy, programs of the government, specific practices at local or national level, the composite of all of that is the state's responsibility. This is all known. This is public information. This is not difficult. The government publishes its laws and its gazette internationally and communicates it to other states. They cannot deny their responsibility. That's much easier to identify and establish than trying to establish an individual's personal culpability for specific breaches like a rape.
John Packer, thank you for joining RFI.
My pleasure.